5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in just a bit, we'll be talking about National Trails Day, which takes place this weekend. First, we heard about the breaking news in Wisconsin this afternoon. A federal judge has overturned the state's same-sex marriage ban, striking down an amendment voters passed in 2006. WPR's Gil Halstead joins us earlier in the program to talk about the decision. We'll be watching for updates throughout the afternoon and next week. And right now, you can share your reactions. Go to the Central Time Facebook page and tell us what you think.
In the meantime, we've got WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky here with us to talk about some of the other stories that took place in Wisconsin this week. Noah, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Veronica.
We're going to start with a story that we've talked about a little bit earlier, the four resignations from a Department of Transportation drunk driving task force. What happened?
Right. So this was a group that has been working on different solutions for the drunk driving issue here in the state. And as we heard, four members of that group very publicly resigned essentially en masse yesterday.
Obviously, that kind of resignation intended to deliver a message.
Right. And that message was that this group of individuals felt that really this process was not to their liking. They said that the Tavern League, which is the lobbying group that represents restaurants and bars and so forth, had too much influence on the group. And they basically argued that the meetings were essentially useless and that documents were drawn up during the course of the meetings that were being advertised as a consensus of the group when, in fact, there was no such consensus.
So we've got that out there, and that's what that group of four is saying. What does the Tavern League have to say about it?
Right. So Tavern League officials deny having any sort of undue influence and point to the fact that the executive director of the group actually hasn't been to a meeting since last August as proof. Their argument is, how can they be the problem if there is nobody around to actually make trouble? In this case, the executive director.
And as far as the reaction from the DOT, now they're sort of at the center of this between both sides. What are they saying? How are they responding?
Yeah, so the DOT issued a statement yesterday where it basically said, it regretted that the members were leaving the task force and that officials would reach out to them in the near future to discuss their concerns. The DOT also noted in a statement that, the number of alcohol-related crashes, injuries, fatalities, et cetera, are in fact decreasing here. In Wisconsin.
You've got these four resignations, and we've heard that the Tavern League says that it's going to continue, I guess, to be part of this group, right? They're going to carry on?
Yeah, the league says absolutely they're going to continue. They're committed to working with the DOT to reduce drunken driving and the fatalities that can result from it. The group says it will continue to work to find a consensus in the group, whatever that consensus might be.
Now, obviously, this is a bigger story. This is what's happened today. But I wonder if you could put into context for us the scope of Wisconsin's issues with alcohol.
Yeah. When I saw the headline, four members of this group resigned, I'd like to think that I was surprised. But I really wasn't because, this latest controversy really speaks to the incredibly complicated relationship the state of Wisconsin has with alcohol and drunken driving. The fact is this state is something of an outlier. Wisconsin is the only state in the country where first offense drunken driving isn't actually a crime. Also, if you look at the statistics, we're also an outlier. The AP, citing data from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, said from 2006 to 2009, 24% of drivers over the age of 16 reported driving impaired. And that is actually the highest number in the country. Now, those are, somewhat old numbers, but I think they still represent, really, they represent the gulf between how this state deals with alcohol and how other states do.
And so this is going to be an ongoing situation to watch. And do you expect, is your news antenna up? Is this going to snowball and become something bigger, a bigger conversation?
Yeah. I think this conversation is ongoing. Clearly this state has a problem with alcohol. It's a huge problem. And given the number and the variety of stakeholders that we have in this state, finding that consensus about how to deal with this issue is going to remain a challenge.
Well, we're going to move on to news from the UW system. The Board of Regents passed a budget for the next school year. What did they decide?
So some good news for parents and students. The plan includes a tuition freeze. Now, the state legislature mandated that freeze, but the regents went a step further, actually, than what state lawmakers wanted to do. Lawmakers initially only wanted that freeze to apply to undergraduates. The regents expanded the freeze to all student groups.
What's the significance of that? Are they trying to, you know, put on a show of good faith?
You know, to be honest with you, it's hard for me to say what's going on inside their heads. But certainly I think the regents are very aware of the scrutiny that they're under right now and the need for transparency and the need to take actions that will be seen as positive by lawmakers.
So we have this tuition freeze that extends beyond undergraduates to all students, it sounds like. What about hikes? Are there any of those included here?
Yes, there are. So we've got the tuition freeze, but the plan actually raises student fees and room and board costs. According to the plan that was just passed, student fees are going to increase about 3.6%. Room and board expenses are increasing by an average of 2.7%. What does that all mean, you ask? For the average UW student, they're going to be paying around $218 more in the next school year than they did this year.
So a little bit more there coming out of fees and room and board expenses. And it sounds like there was also movement on the Wisconsin Higher Education Grant Program. What action did the regents take there?
Yeah, the regents also voted in favor of asking legislators for more money for that program. They're asking for around $15 million additional dollars in order to eliminate a waiting list that has around 3,500 people on it now. The additional money would also be used to increase the actual average amount of that award.
And the Wisconsin Higher Education Grant Program, what does it do? What's the point of it?
Yeah, so it offers awards for those who need financial assistance. The regents are asking that the award increase by a little less than $100. So that would bring the award to around $1,800 if state lawmakers agree.
And we're going to move last to a Wisconsin story that's actually gone national. It's not the kind of story you really want to see go national out of Wisconsin, but there it is, some stabbings near Waukesha.
Right. So this is one of the most unusual stories, frankly, to come out of Wisconsin, at least in recent years. Two 12-year-old girls have been accused of stabbing their friend 19 times, almost killing her, at a park in Waukesha County.
And what is it that grabbed people's attention? What is it that is significant about this case?
Yeah, one of the things that I think really, you know, brought people's attention was the fact that the girls said they did it in order to curry favor with a fictional character on the internet called Slenderman. Apparently, the girls wanted to prove he actually existed.
So obviously lots of facets here. These are 12-year-old girls we're talking about. They obviously had an unhealthy relationship with this fictional character. It's unclear about the borders of fantasy and reality. But what are some of the angles that the news is picking up on, different facets here?
Yeah, so there are a few angles. Certainly one is whether or not the girls should be tried as adults, which they currently are. That could change if defense attorneys convince a judge to move them to juvenile court. But that's certainly an issue we're going to watch. Because if they do get moved to juvenile court, that means that, they'd really only be incarcerated probably until their mid-20s. So it puts a pretty significant cap on the punishment. Another angle of the issue is the online viewing habits of preteens. You kind of alluded to that. What are these horror websites all about? You know, how involved should parents be in monitoring their kids? Another angle, if any warning signs there may have been, and right now, frankly, it doesn't seem like there were any that this crime was going to take place.
What have people in the community been saying about the girls? Were there indications that anybody picked up on?
The principal of the school the girls attended said they were good students with no prior behavioral issues. The principal, as quoted by the AP, said they were, quote, just normal students.
Mm. And we haven't heard a lot about the victim. Her identity hasn't been released, but what do we know about how she's doing?
Yeah, the victim, the media, including us, we're not naming her, but she is reportedly in fair condition. Doctors did note that she was very, very lucky. I mean, she was stabbed 19 times, and in fact, she was stabbed very close to her heart. So very, very lucky to be alive.
Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Noah.
Thanks.
That was WPR's Assistant News Director, Noah Ovshinsky. We're celebrating the trail system in the United States. Every year on the first Saturday of June, the American Hiking Society coordinates National Trails Day, which features a series of outdoor activities to promote and celebrate the importance of trails.
And we want to hear from you. Why do you love hiking? Why is hiking important to you? Where do you like to get outside, either in or out of Wisconsin? Do you have a trail to recommend? And are you doing anything this weekend to mark National Trails Day? Call right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send a quick email to talk@WPR.org.
Peter Olson is with us. He's Vice President for Programs and Government Relations for the American Hiking Society. Peter, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Peter, tell us about National Trails Day. How did it get started?
Well, it started 22 years ago now, actually. The White House at the time actually issued a report called Trails for All Americans that, you know, recommended that Americans get out more and enjoy their trails and also give back to their trails. And the American Hiking Society started coordinating National Trails Day to encourage all sorts of local hosts. It's hiking clubs and trail clubs, true, but it's also public lands trusts and state park managers and national park managers and forests. To host local events that get people in that community outdoors to enjoy the trails, enjoy the parks, as well as a lot of them also have stewardship components where people do a little giving back with trail maintenance or trail building.
Are Americans hiking as much as they used to? Where is the state of hiking today?
Actually, there are more Americans hiking today than there were, I would say, 6 years ago. But yeah, Americans, thankfully, are still getting outside. We haven't lost our ability to walk quite yet. but yeah, Americans are, you know, I think the fact is that so many people, you know, had staycations, especially in recent years. And that hiking is something that can be done certainly on the cheap and close to home. So you can make it a hiking trip as exotic as you want. You can go to a foreign country, you can climb mountains, you can buy expensive gear. Or you can put on a good pair of shoes and hit the trail right nearby. It's the kind of adventure that you want that day.
And these days we have a network of trails across the country. How has the hiking system sort of evolved in terms of what's out there for people over the years?
Well, the hiking system has evolved over the years. I forget the exact year. I think it was 1968, when the National Trail System Act was enacted by Congress, and that created national scenic and historic trails. And those are, generally speaking, longer distance trails, especially on behalf of the scenic ones. And so those trails get, you know, they're congressionally mandated, and they get some funding from the federal government to help substantiate them, their business, and their and manage those trails, as well as acquire land when it's available so that the trails don't have gaps. So that, by having them congressionally mandated, it helps give them a degree of permanence that not all local trails are able to get.
And we're going to go to the phone lines right now and take a call from Bonnie in Shell Lake. Hi, Bonnie.
Well, hi. I just need you to have people go to Washburn, Wisconsin. You need to stop at Coco's to get some nourishment. Then you go about 1 mile north of Washburn, and you will see a right, and that is called Houghton Road. You go down there about a quarter mile, and there is a small parking lot, and you start walking. It's almost like a gully, but it turns into almost a canyon. It eventually empties into Lake Superior. It is absolutely gorgeous. Whatever season you go, you'll love it. It is not a difficult trail. It is gorgeous.
That does sound beautiful. Bonnie, what is that trail called again?
Houghton, H-O-U-G-H-T-O-N Falls.
Houghton Falls Trail. Excellent. Thank you. That's a great tip to have. We appreciate you calling. And let's ask you, Peter. I know you're not supposed to pick a favorite trail. It's like picking a favorite child, right? But I'm going to ask you to do it anyway. What is one of your favorite hiking trails?
Oh, now see, you can't do that. One of my personal favorites is the Long Trail up in Vermont. The scenery is spectacular up there. They've got lots of shelters. So, you know, many of us backpack that particular trail. And so it can make your day as short or as long as you want. And the scenery is phenomenal. You go through a bit of a wilderness area at one point. But honestly, I've hiked all across this nation, and there are just beautiful trails everywhere. I think what surprises most people is how close to home they can go hiking and just how beautiful it is and how different it appears when you're on the trail.
That's an interesting point. So when you get out there and you're actually hoofing it, you're on foot, the world looks a little different.
Oh, absolutely. And people... You know, I don't live far from Baltimore, and people, you know, think Baltimore is this big, built-up city, which it is. It's a big city. But I'd say 3 miles outside of their beltway, there is a beautiful state park. It's enormous. It has views that are, you wouldn't believe you're that close to Baltimore.
Hmm. All right. Well, that's another interesting one. And we have an open line for you right now. Your vote for your favorite hiking trail, the one that has the most beauty, the best view, the biggest challenges if you're into the hills. What is your favorite hiking trail in the state and in the whole country if you've traveled and done a lot of hiking? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 as we observe National Trails Day today on Central Time. And Peter, for people who maybe are a little new to hiking, they are not wanting to do anything too strenuous but start out and have a good experience, what should they know?
Well, the first thing we tell people is if you're going to go for a hike, even if you're going with other people, let somebody who's not going with you know where you're going and when you expect to return. People never plan on getting lost, but it happens. So always let somebody know where you're going. I would say as far as people who are a little bit newer to it, it's not a race. While it can be physically challenging, if that's what you want to make of it, I would say, generally speaking, sauntering is fine. Thoreau said it is a fine art to saunter. And who are we to argue with Thoreau? So I would say take it easy. Pay attention to your feet, depending on the footwear that you're wearing. If you're doing a lot of uphill or downhill, you could be prone to blisters. As soon as you think you're getting a blister, you want to address it. Don't let it get worse thinking it's going to get better because it doesn't ever get better on its own. Bring some extra water with you, bring some extra food. And if you're hiking with kids, the biggest thing is to let the kids set the pace. And know that for kids, it's really about stopping and exploring and playing with rocks and sticks. And if you come across a stream or water, good luck getting the kids away from the water.
And you have to accept that, right? It's part of the journey, the experience of hiking.
It is. I mean, and it is different with children, but we always encourage families to get the children out young and get them going. If you're hiking without children, then you can make it a bit more of a, you know, a lot of people like to hike to, say, a waterfall or hike to a particular overlook. And that sets the destination for them, and that can be fun as well. The other thing I would say, though, is when people are out there hiking, take breaks, sit down, and be quiet for a few minutes. When you're sitting down and you're quiet is when you're going to see the wildlife and the birds and all the beauty that's around you. But when you're moving, the wildlife tends to stay away from you. So, you know, you're outdoors. Enjoy it. Don't rush through it.
Good advice. Let's go back to our callers now. Stephen is joining us in Eau Claire. Hi, Stephen. Stephen, are you with us?
Is that me?
Yep. Yep, you are on the air.
Dave, okay. You're talking about hiking trails. I recommend highly the Wonderland Trail around Mount Rainier. Both Backpacker Magazine and Outsider Magazine has rated it as either the best or one of the best in the entire United States. Very difficult, 93 miles, very strenuous, but unbelievable views, just as gorgeous as you can get looking up at, you know, the second highest peak in the United States. So the Wonderland Trail around Mount Rainier is spectacular.
All right. Well, thank you for that vote. That sounds lovely. You got to be in shape for that one, it sounds like. Thank you, Stephen. And quickly to Sean and Racine. Sean, what is your vote for favorite trail?
I'm going to vote for the Ice Age National Scenic Trail. It's a 1,200-mile trail that runs across the entire state of Wisconsin. It runs from about Sturgeon Bay down through West Bend near Milwaukee to Janesville, then up through the central part of the state through Madison, up towards Wausau, Antigo area, and then it shoots west to St. Croix Falls.
Excellent. And I'm going to second you on that one. The Ice Age Trail, I've hiked little bits of it, not all of it, but it's got some pretty spectacular moments there. Peter, thank you so much for joining us today and talking National Trails Day.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Peter Olson, Vice President for Programs and Government Relations for the American Hiking Society. He joined us to talk about National Trails Day, which is tomorrow. Central Time, I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll dive into the world of extra virgin olive oil on Food Friday.
First, Wisconsin is in the midst of a battle against heroin addiction and overdoses around the state. It's something we've been following here on Central Time.
Earlier this year, Governor Walker signed into law a set of bills aimed at stemming addiction and making it easier for emergency responders to respond to overdoses.
Today, the State Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse released a set of recommendations focused on treatment and prevention of heroin use. They come following a heroin symposium earlier this week in Milwaukee.
Here with us to talk about these new recommendations from a medical perspective is Dr. Sarah Andrizzi. She works with Advanced Pain Management and practices at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She spoke earlier this week at that heroin summit in Milwaukee. Dr. Andrizzi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, as we mentioned, we've got a parcel of new legislation out there. Still more to do, you think, when it comes to heroin addiction in Wisconsin?
Certainly, yes. And, you know, we in the medical community, these recommendations are brand new. So they just came out earlier today. Mm-hmm. So we're in the midst, you know, we in the medical community are in the midst of kind of going through, sifting through this 80-page document regarding these recommendations. And we're all very interested in seeing how we can all kind of collaboratively work together, state and local government, law enforcement, community workers, education, and medical professionals can work together to reduce heroin and other prescription opioid overdose deaths.
What are a couple of the next steps you'd like to see Wisconsin take and that coalition of different partners you mentioned take when it comes to preventing heroin addiction in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Well, and prevention is one of the key. There were five pillars of the recommendations that were put forth today, and prevention is one of the, and actually the first kind of key pillar. And so in that category, they are looking to promote increased community awareness about substance abuse and also to try and kind of reduce the stigma associated with substance abuse and associated with, you know, obtaining help for substance abuse issues. They're also looking to increase funding for substance abuse coalitions, providing alternative opportunities for at-risk youth to, you know, provide other options for them as far as things to help prevent heroin specifically, but any drug use initially, and then also getting them access to substance abuse treatment if that is an issue down the line. And then the other big point under the prevention category, they are looking to recruit employers, government agencies, nonprofits to really get involved in prevention and intervention activities.
That's the prevention pillar. What are some of the other key points in today's recommendations?
Correct. The other four pillars from the recommendation include harm reduction, and under that category include things like syringe exchange programs, HIV, hepatitis C testing programs for at-risk drug users, increasing funding for naloxone, which is branded under the brand name of Narcan, which is the anti-heroin overdose drug, increasing funding for that and training for that so that we can get that into the hands of other members of the community, whether that be first responders, police officers, EMTs, et cetera. Along with that, they're looking to provide prescriptions for Narcan along with opioid prescriptions. That is one of their recommendations. The third pillar that went along with these recommendations was the law enforcement pillar. Basically, they are recommending that communities develop a system wherein community members can turn over illegal drugs or legal prescription drugs that they maybe have obtained illegally or are no longer using and be able to properly dispose of those medications without significant repercussions, legal repercussions.
So a no questions asked sort of way to get rid of drugs that came into your possession one way or another.
Exactly correct. Mm-hmm.
And then that leaves two more pillars.
Correct. The fourth pillar is the treatment recommendations. The main recommendations in this pillar include increasing access to inpatient detoxification programs and inpatient and then outpatient community support programs. And as you know, a member of the medical community who deals with a lot of opioid abuse in particular, that is an area of interest, I believe, particularly for the medical community. It's an area of difficulty for us in really directing patients towards these resources. And then the fifth pillar is workplace recommendations. So encouraging every workplace to have a clear workplace anti-drug policy, encouraging employers to have in place education and prevention resources for their employees, training for supervisors as to how they can identify drug use amongst their employees, how they can report that, and then consistent drug testing programs for workplace environments.
I want to dig deeper into one theme that came up a couple times there and a story we've heard again and again where people start on prescription opioids, either that were prescribed to them for a valid medical reason or that they've gotten from a relative or bought from someone, and then ultimately turning into a heroin addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need to be prescribing these medications less in the first place? How do you balance pain management versus risk of addiction?
It's a good question, and it's a tricky question to adequately address. And we know a couple of things. Number one, we know that since 1999, so for the past 13 years that we have this data, opioid-related, and this is prescription, opioid-related deaths have significantly increased every year. And those parallel the increase in opioid prescriptions that have been given in the U.S. We also know that between 1992 and the mid-2000s, the amount of opioid prescriptions that were given in the United States increased by about 150%. But at that same time, the number of teenagers who are new illicit prescription drug users increased by over 500%. So we know that, you know, going along with this increase in opioid prescription is an increase in illicit or using these medications not as prescribed, especially amongst teenagers. And at that same time, we have seen a significant increase in heroin overdose and heroin use. From 2009 to 2013 in Wisconsin, the number of heroin overdose deaths increased by 170%. So, I mean, it's a significant increase in a short period of time. And we know that prescription opioids and illegal drugs such as heroin, they work on the same mechanisms in the brain. Basically, in 1895, Bayer Drug Group introduced a new pain medication, which was they claimed would be a non-addictive replacement for morphine. They called it diacetylmorphine, and they branded it under the name of heroin. So we know that heroin and opioid prescriptions, they're all related, and when we see the risk or the increase in prescription medications and the risk of prescription opioid-related deaths increase, we know that there is a correlation with the increase in heroin deaths also.
Well, as we wrap up now, we've got these recommendations. You've got these recommendations out today. Where do they go? Who picks them up and runs with them?
So, again, it's going to be kind of a collaborative effort between law enforcement, community groups, employers, healthcare, the medical community, and then state and local governments. And so it really is, and they've outlined, you know, ways that all of these groups can kind of work together. And it is going to be, you know, a multi-prong approach to trying to reduce these deaths.
Dr. Andrizzi, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Dr. Sarah Andrizzi. She works in advanced pain management and practices at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She spoke earlier this week at a heroin symposium in Milwaukee, and today the State Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse released a set of recommendations focused on treatment and prevention of heroin use.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Food Friday. Today we're diving into the world of olive oil.
With plenty of options and varieties of olive oil to choose from, it can be hard to know what to pick out at the grocery store. And then once we finally pick an olive oil, sometimes we just use it as a salad dressing or a bread dip. But our next guest says there's much more we can be doing with olive oil, and she's got the recipes to prove it.
Mary Plattis joins us now. She's a chef and a food blogger and the co-author of the book Cooking Techniques and Recipes with Olive Oil. Mary, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Well, I gather from your book, you are a huge fan of olive oil. What makes it so special?
Well, I am. Being Greek, it runs through our veins, so that's number one. But most importantly, it is a cornerstone of the Mediterranean diet that we're all talking about. It's a heart-healthy oil, and it's the only oil you should be using in your cooking.
So it's hard to know what to pick up because there's a million bottles of olive oil these days at the grocery store, and you want the good stuff. You don't want stuff that's been filtered down usually or mixed with other things. How do we know that we're picking out a good bottle?
You know, that's a very good question. And as the years go by, I'm noticing that the section at the grocery store is getting smaller and smaller, which is good for the consumer. But once you pick out an extra virgin olive oil, not a virgin or a pure, it must say extra virgin olive oil, there's several things you can look for. And one of them is the organic seal. That guarantees a first cold-pressed olive oil. So look for seals like the California Olive Oil Commission. Or if you're getting a European olive oil, look for the IOOC seal. But if none of those are on there, what you can do is turn your bottle around, and if it says extra virgin olive oil as the only ingredient, then you've got a great bottle. Because if it's this refined oil, you must put it down. That means it's mixed in with, you know, fake oil or bad oils, bad saturated oils. So overall, and one more thing, make sure it has a harvest date, not a best buy date. That's sort of a supermarket thing, you know, they add on those bottles, but it must have a harvest date, which tells you it was produced in 2014.
So you can't go by color either, it sounds like. That's not part of the criteria.
Yeah, no, color has absolutely, you know, olive oil comes in various colors according to when it has been picked and processed. So that's no indication, unfortunately.
So when you
select an olive oil, make sure it's in a dark bottle. And make sure that you buy a small bottle, not those big tin cans, because, you know, most consumers can't use up that much olive oil within a year.
So you say we should be cooking with olive oil, doing just about everything in it. And there are probably two responses out there. Some people are saying, of course, I cook with olive oil all the time. And some people are saying, no, wait, I heard you're not supposed to heat olive oil up too much. Smoke points, bad things happen, that sort of thing. Can we cook pretty much any temperature, anything with olive oil?
You know, absolutely. Those are all misconceptions. Olive oil smokes at, and I think people are getting confused with the smoking point and the actual heating point. A good olive oil can go all the way up to between 365 and 400. So most people don't fry over that amount, you know, that temperature. And if they do, they have to actually fry for over like 90 minutes before the olive oil begins to lose its nutrients. And most people don't fry for 90 minutes. So that's what the studies are showing. So yes, you can cook with it. In Europe, that's all they use. And Americans are starting to use olive oil now that they hear that it's a healthier choice.
So what does olive oil do to the flavor of the food we're eating? I know it varies in flavor. It can be kind of sharper and peppier, more peppery. Mm-hmm. It can be sort of fruity tasting. But how does it sort of change the chemistry of the food we're eating?
Well, it doesn't change the chemistry as much as it enhances the flavor. So let's say you use a first press harvest, which is early in the fall. That's a pungent, very strong olive oil, and those olive oils can be used for braising, a roast, or it could be used for if you want a pungent flavor when cooking something like roasting a chicken. And then you can use the mid-season, which is January and February. That's the second round of milling the olives, and it has a slight milder taste. So you can use that for your vegetables, and most people don't know that there are three different types of oils. And later in the season, in the spring, you'll get a very mild, and that's what most consumers love. So if you like that mild, buttery flavor, you can use it. You can actually use it in your ice cream and baking goods.
Well, let's follow up with that baking concept. You sent us a recipe. We've got it up on the Central Time Facebook page. It is dark chocolate olive oil cake with strawberries. You had me a dark chocolate cake and strawberries, but what does the olive oil do for a chocolate cake recipe?
Well, for any baking, what we're doing is we're substituting butter. And in most European recipes, they use olive oil in substitution for butter. So we're taking the fat out, the saturated fat of the butter out, and we're adding the olive oil. And in something like this where you're using a dark chocolate, you can use just about any olive oil. And it just gives it a nice moist. It keeps the baked goods moist and rich in flavor.
Well, we're in Wisconsin. Are you saying something is better than dairy in a cake?
No, we all love our cheeses and we all love our butters. We're just giving you options so that you can use up that great bottle of olive oil that was given to you, you know, perhaps for a birthday or a gift.
Can you walk us through that recipe a little bit? It was beautiful. We all stopped and ogled it when we got to that page.
Well, you know, it's a perfect summer recipe because who doesn't like chocolate, right? And strawberries are coming into season.
Right.
And basically, it's a throw-together recipe. You add your flour and cocoa powder, all the dry ingredients together, and then you mix your sugar. And it also has Greek yogurt, by the way, which is also a great choice instead of sour cream or, you know, again, butter. And then you add the olive oil, and you combine those to three or four ingredients. And in just small batches, you mix the flour together with the dry ingredients with the wet ingredients and add your chocolate chips. That's it. And you just arrange your strawberries on top, stick it in the oven for 40, 45 minutes, and when it comes out, you gently can add some powdered sugar. Yum. Or how about a scoop of vanilla ice cream?
Wow.
Well, it's grilling season, turning away from desserts for a moment. Do you have tips on marinating using olive oil or a suggested recipe?
We do. In fact, marinating is what most people use when they're making a homemade marinade. We're trying to get away from the processed bottles and also the dry ingredients that you add that you're not quite sure is in those dry powders. So we have several recipes for chicken kebabs. And we also marinate pork tenderloin and salmon and New York strip steak, and any of those can be thrown on the barbecue.
And that's the beauty of it, huh? You can just, it's already been marinating in the olive oil, so you don't have to grease the grill. Can you just stick it on the grill?
That's right. And what's really nice is it keeps the moisture in the meat as well when you marinate with olive oil. So, and it also protects your meat or your chicken while it's on the grill. So it has several different benefits for that grilling season.
And here's was a new one to me in your cookbook, drinks with olive oil. That I don't think of olive oil as a cocktail mixer.
Well, it was a long night. No, my partner and I were mixing up a little drink one evening, and we had a little bit of vodka and some ouzo, and we had decided to add watermelon and a little bit of olive oil on top, and it makes a great shot.
What does it do to it? Does it just help it go down nice and smooth?
Yeah, you know, it helps the vodka with its flavor. In fact, you know how strong it can be sometimes? So in a little shot glass, so when we added the oil coats your mouth before the vodka hits it. So it just goes down smoother.
Sounds like
a couple more.
Like hot, yeah, right. Hot buttered rum, but not hot and no rum and no butter. Well, how about we've got our good olive oil. How about some storage tips? How do we keep it good for as long as it lasts?
Well, that's a very good question, and many people do put their olive oil next to their oven because that's, you know, that's just simple and easy.
Yeah.
But basically, it needs to be away from the heat in your pantry as well as away from light, because light oxidizes the olive oil, and that's why they put it in the dark bottle. And let's say you do buy a great bottle of olive oil at a farm or a store, and it's in a clear bottle. We suggest that you pour it out into an old wine bottle or a darker container, and place it in your pantry.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Mary, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's Mary Plattis. She's a chef and a food blogger. We've been talking about the book she co-authored. It's called Cooking Techniques and Recipes with Olive Oil.
And don't forget, we've got that recipe for that dark chocolate strawberry cake with olive oil and Greek yogurt up on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're going to make that this weekend? Bring it in on Monday?
Did you read my mind?
Yeah.
Yes, I am going to make it this
you really
weekend.
Are? Oh, awesome.
I think I am.
Maybe wait, you didn't say you were going to bring it in. Yeah.
No, I didn't say that.